Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I fought against long odds in a deep blue state, but I was a severely conservative Republican governor.
The political soundbite of the weekend from the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., a much derided ad lib there by Mitt Romney, with Rush Limbaugh pouncing on it early and many others following. We will play a longer version of that clip for more context coming up. And yet, Romney won the CPAC straw poll, which, by the way, he has now won three times since 2007. So let's talk about the nomination. Let's talk about contraception and the president's health law compromise and more after CPAC weekend. Let's talk to three people who were there. Jennifer Rubin, who writes the conservative blog Right Turn for the Washington Post. Brian Darling from the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank. He's also a columnist for Human Events. And Carol Markowitz, blogger for Our Politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Hello to all of you. Can you all hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Did any of you get to vote in the CPAC straw poll, or were you all there as journalists or observers? Any voters?
I didn't vote, no.
All right. Well, after a whole year of everyone on Romney for not being a consistent conservative, Carol, how does he win the CPAC straw poll? Is the conference held in D.C. just not that grassroots?
Oh, no, it's definitely grassroots, but Romney has won four out of the last six CPAC polls, so it's not that far out that he won. I think there was a sense, definitely, that he is an inevitable candidate. I saw your piece, Jennifer, that you don't think that that's the feeling, but I do think that most people think he is the candidate, and all and Santorum and Newt were just kind of side candidates for a while, but aren't going anywhere now. So I think that people are just trying to pick the winner, and they think it's going to be Romney.
I want to do something that we do here often, which is play a longer version of a soundbite than we usually get in what Limbaugh calls the drive-by media. So here's about a minute of Romney leading up to when he calls himself severely conservative.
During my term in office, I also stood up to those who wanted to call into question the very definition of life. I vetoed a bill that would have opened the door to cloning and to embryo farming. I vetoed a bill that would have allowed young girls to obtain access to abortion-inducing drugs. I fought for abstinence education in our schools. And I defended the right of the Catholic Church to serve the community in ways that were consistent with their conscience through adoption programs that place children in a home with a mom and a dad. My state was a leading indicator of what liberals would be trying to do across the country and are trying to do right now. And I fought against long odds in a deep blue state. But I was a severely conservative Republican governor.
Romney at CPAC, a longer version. Jennifer, you buying it?
Well, to begin with, I think you're playing the clip and the media obsessing over the clip is exactly why the media has blown it again and again in this race. And that is that they have a different interest than the actual voters. The actual voters, I think, are actually paying attention to the substance. And a slip of the tongue here or a slip of the tongue there or what's obviously a fumble isn't going to determine their votes. But the general impression of the candidates, the record of the candidates, the persona of the candidates does. And that's, I think, why the media again and again keeps getting the narrative wrong or keeps being surprised, because they're not really following the race in the way the voters are following the race.
But it seems
now,
to be the conservative...
Excuse me. Now, as far as the CPAC gathering goes, he actually received a much more enthusiastic reception than did Santorum. If, for those of us who were there, he had multiple standing ovations. It was, I think, one of his better speeches. A single speech is not going to convince people who are skeptical, and it's never going to convince people who don't want to be convinced. But I think it began a process for him. Number one, that explains why he's a conservative. He tied it into various points in his life. And two, did set out some specifics. When I interviewed him one-on-one afterwards, he went farther than he has before, both on foreign policy issues and promising a more complete tax plan.
Brian, do you think that severely rub people the wrong way because conservatives are sensitive to being stereotyped as mean and severe?
I kind of liked it. I feel like I'm a severe conservative. So if he's speaking to severe conservatives, he's winning me over. But I don't think this race is over by a long shot. I think, yeah, I like Mitt Romney. I think he gave a decent speech. It was a little bit flat. As you saw, the convention closed, the meeting closed with Sarah Palin, who had people on their feet for most of her speech. And I think Santorum did a very good job. I think Gingrich did a great job. But you look at what's going on in this primary race, it's clearly not over. There's a long way to go. And as we all probably will agree that Mitt Romney's a front runner, but he has not closed out this race yet. And we're going to see a lot more fighting, especially going into Super Tuesday.
Since I would agree with that, Brian.
Go ahead.
And part of what we saw, I think, is that both these candidates, I think, in a sense, are stronger than the media would portray them. They both have strong points. They both had a well-crafted speech. And I think we are having a competitive primary and will continue to have one for some time. And it is, I think, very much akin to 2008 when Hillary and Barack Obama battled it out over a long period of time.
Brian, do you want to amplify at all on your embracing of the word severe? Seriously, what does it mean to you?
Well, I'm kind of joking around about it, but anytime you get in front of a bunch of conservatives and you try and out-conservative the other candidates, you're a winner. I mean, I think it's something where it'll get people on their feet when you say something like that. But what does it really mean? You know, a severe conservative, if that means that you believe in everything that the conservative movement believes, sign me up. There's nothing wrong with that. I think the word severe has some negative connotations, but I don't think anybody was offended. Clearly, it was a mini slip-up, but, nobody's going to hold that against Mitt Romney, especially in a Republican primary.
So the competition goes on, as you all say. And, Carol, you sat in with me and Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, last week on It's a Free Country, the podcast, where we bring our revealing sound bites of the week. And you brought this, the long-awaited endorsement in the Republican primaries from Eric Erickson of Red State.
My choice for president of the United States is the sweet meteor of death. Yes, that's right, the sweet meteor of death. Now, I've decided a pox on all their houses. They're all terrible. I doubt any of them can beat Barack Obama unless the economy goes back down, which it may very well, in which case they don't need my endorsement. They'll have the economy.
So, Carol, you may well have brought the soundbite of the week to the It's a Free Country podcast last week, but for the record, you got on the Eric Erickson bandwagon on that show and seconded the nomination for the sweet meteor of death. Why is that your...
That's my first choice. Your my second choice.
Second. Why is that your skeptical conservative conclusion at this point? In other words, why are you so unenthusiastic?
It's obviously depressing, the field. The candidates, they're fine. They're just not superstars. We didn't get a superstar field this time. We didn't get a Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton. That was the best that the Democrats could do. And it was two powerhouses coming up against each other. What we have is three candidates that people like about 6 on a scale of 1 through 10 at most. And it's a little depressing, and you do wish the meteor will hit before we really have to choose one of them. So, yeah, it's not the best situation for Republicans. But compared to Barack Obama, obviously, it doesn't even need to be said. Any one of them would be better.
All right, let me jump in because we're getting some interference there, I think, from your
that
BlackBerry.
That might be from the meteor.
From the meteor or from the media, one or the other trying
the
to
meteor, the sweet meteor of death. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Exactly. So, Jennifer Rubin, is conservatism in any kind of identity crisis now with no real candidate, if you accept what Carol was saying, just 2 years after the Tea Party swept so many conservatives into Congress?
I don't agree with what she's saying, and I don't think conservatism is in some kind of slump. In fact, if you look at the candidates, all of them are much more conservative than the winner last time, 2008.
And I agree with that.
And we're talking about gradations of policy. We're talking about who has the least number of clunkers, as Tim Pawlenty said in his record. very funny that Marco Rubio, during an interview that I was doing of him during CPAC, said, you know, it's funny. Liberals don't want to be called liberals. They want to be called a new word, progressive, which is actually an old word. But conservatives are always fighting over who's the real conservative. And that's because conservative ideas still have a very strong hold on the party. And you have candidates who are trying to prove their conservative credentials. And I think that, in some sense, is the legacy of the Tea Party in moving the party to the right and into and highlighting the fiscal issues, particularly the debt and the deficit, which we've never had a grassroots movement that was against spending. We've had tax revolts, we've had social conservative movements, but we really haven't had a limited government movement. And that legacy, I think, leads on. One of these candidates is going to win the nomination, and that person then is going to carry an agenda that is in large part identical to what the Tea Party agenda was. Whether or not, you know, Carroll or some guy who frankly thought Rick Perry was the answer to the party, which was Eric Erickson, is pleased or not, you know, is neither here nor there. It's whether the conservative movement and its ideas survive. And I think there's no question that they do. We don't have somebody who's running on an isolationist, big spending, raise taxes program. That's just not going to win in the Republican Party.
That's true, but we do have a candidate that supported RomneyCare when one of the big issues of the Tea Party was defeating Obamacare. So it's not the best situation for us.
And he's pledged to repeal Obamacare in large part, once again, because he has to ally himself and align himself with the conservative movement. So in each case, both these candidates, to the extent that they've had clunkers, are now trying to reverse themselves. For example, Rick Santorum has some really bad votes on labor issues. He's now come around and he says, I would vote for right-to-work legislation on a national basis. That's the power of the Tea Party movement and conservatism, that candidates who had what we would consider to be bad votes in the past now want to get on the right side of those issues.
But is the issue there then, Jennifer, credibility? Why do you believe somebody who's saying something now and they're running in the primaries that's different from their records, and then they're going to turn around and run in the general election, which might demand a whole other kind of politics?
This is always a concern in politics, and whether you are for a particular candidate or against a particular candidate, you tend to, I think, employ a different standard depending upon whether it's your guy or the other guy. Mitt Romney's big issue, of course, is RomneyCare. But Santorum has, as I pointed out, labor issues. He has earmarks. He voted for Medicare Part D. He voted for No Child Left Behind. And his supporters say, you know what, put those things aside. Let's look at the big picture. He's really a conservative. So both sides have this issue and have this problem. And I think part of what an election does is begin to tease out whether these were aberrational or whether the individual really has a reflexive support for organized labor, for example, or reflexive support for a lot of government action. And that, I think, is going to be one of the issues going forward.
So, Brian Darling from the Heritage Foundation, let me turn to you with this follow-up, because some of the things that are now labeled as too liberal for 2012, too liberal for 2012, may have been seen as conservative positions in the past. And maybe even one or two of them came out of Heritage in some way or another, like the individual mandate in RomneyCare. We know that Gingrich also endorsed that was seen as kind of a personal responsibility thing on some level. We know that cap and trade used to be seen as kind of a market thing on some level. We know that No Child Left Behind used to be seen by President Bush and others as a standards thing and something that implied and provided school choice, especially for low-income kids, kind of a conservative thing. So do these issues just migrate from one side to the other over time, depending on who's embracing them?
No. I think what we're seeing is, when you look at the issue of the individual mandate, is guys like Newt Gingrich and Don Nichols and others embraced it as a defensive mechanism to defeat Hillary Care. So you're looking back at the Hillary Care fight, the first fight on government-controlled health care, and many conservatives rolled it out as a way to defeat bigger government. So they used, you know, a defensive mechanism, the individual mandate. And it's pretty clear now. I mean, you look at the research of the Heritage Foundation, we've been very clear that the individual mandate is not part of the powers of the federal government. The Commerce Clause does not reach into the states to allow the federal government to tell every American you have to buy a certain product in the stream of commerce. You look at the other issues that you bring up. I mean, the bottom line is the Tea Party movement right now is looking at all these candidates, and they're seeing they're not all that excited about them. That you look at all of the candidates, they have their flaws, but there's one thing they all have in common. They're not Barack Obama, and the American people have rejected the comprehensive health care plan of the president. They've rejected a stimulus plan that didn't do anything for the economy. So when you look at the general election, it may be a situation where the American people rally around the guy that's not Barack Obama, and that may be a determining factor in the election if this does become a referendum on the presidency of Barack Obama.
But, Carol, some Democrats and liberals might say it's only about what uniform you're wearing, because if Barack Obama tried to move to the center by embracing the individual mandate that conservatives used to see as an alternative to Hillary Care, moved to the center by embracing cap and trade, which conservatives used to see as a market-oriented solution to global warming, and then all of a sudden these things get labeled socialism, then what's a Democrat trying to be a moderate to do?
I don't think Obama can sell himself as a moderate at this point to most people. He had some moderate ideas coming in, but he actually tried to push so many big government solutions that I don't think that would be plausible for 2012. He is running against the candidates right now in the Republican field are all pretty moderate, so he does have... I know Jennifer thinks that they're the most conservative people we've ever found. For some reason, the rest of the world
Santorum is a pretty conservative guy.
Her.
I don't know why you would characterize Santorum as a moderate. That's really, you know, kind of
He might
be
a religious conservative, but he's certainly a big government moderate. I most of the conservative world has been writing on this and saying that about him. He has some serious flaws in terms of small government conservatism. And his labor problems are just one part of that. His support of Arlen Specter is a huge flaw in his record. So Barack Obama will have the advantage of not running against anybody who the Conservative Party will be too fired up about. But I do agree that because they are not Barack Obama, they will enjoy the support of the Republicans in November.
We'll continue in a minute with our panel of three people who attended the CPAC conference over the weekend, and we will turn to the issue that a lot of people were talking about there and around the country over the weekend, and that is President Obama's attempt at a compromise on the issue of contraception and religious organizations in the health reform law. Stay with us.
The kind of coercion that we can expect. It's not about contraception. It's about economic liberty. It's about freedom of speech. It's about freedom of religion. It's about government control of your lives, and it's got to stop.
Rick Santorum at CPAC from his speech as we aired on Meet the Press yesterday. And let's talk about this contraception coverage issue that continued to roil. Over the weekend, the Conference of Bishops rejected and the more liberal Catholic groups embraced it. This compromise policy announced by the president on Friday.
Under the rule, women will still have access to free preventive care that includes contraceptive services, no matter where they work.
The president on Friday, and still with me, three guests who attended the CPAC conference over the weekend, Carol Markowitz, conservative blogger for WNYC's politics website, It's a Free Country, Jennifer Rubin, who writes the Right Turn column for The Washington Post, and Brian Darling, senior fellow for government studies at the Heritage Foundation and a contributor to Human Events. Do any of you three accept this compromise as the president framed it?
No. Well, it's not a compromise. I mean, if you look at what the president said, his ultimate proposal still forces employers and employees to bear the cost of, and we're not just talking about contraception, we're talking about abortion-inducing drugs and sterilization. So you're going to still have that cost passed on to religious organizations. So it obviously this is not an accommodation. There's nothing free. I mean, you can say that you're going to force the insurance companies to pay for these services, but that cost in the end will be shifted onto religious institutions. And if they aren't granted a waiver or given some sort of an exemption from this coverage, it's still offensive to religious faith-based organizations.
Carol, liberals will say that the actuarial tables show that there should be a lower premium for religious organizations if they include contraception coverage or, you know, third party access to contraception coverage, because then the insured in their policies will have fewer pregnancies and, by the way, fewer abortions, which are more expensive from the insurance company's point of view than contraception.
And that implies that anybody who is looking for birth control and doesn't get it on their health care plan will then not seek birth control. I mean, that's ridiculous. And in no way will the insurance company provide this for free. So it's a really basic thing to understand. The insurance companies will not give it for free. The religious organizations will have to pay for it if it's part of the plan. And that's just how it is.
Is there data on this? I've yet to be able to really look it up as to whether plans with contraception coverage actually cost more than plans without, or cost less, or cost the same. Jennifer, do you have any idea?
Well, let's try not to be economically illiterate as the president was. This notion that you don't have to pay for something is sort of akin to if Brian, for example, went to his car insurance company and said, why don't you pay for a bigger car for me because bigger cars are safer than smaller cars? Does he get a free big car because it's safer? This is really sort of the height of what is wrong with Barack Obama's approach to governance. First of all, it's built on an economic fallacy, which is that it's for free. Whether you're an insurance company, whether you're a consumer, you pay something for birth control. Otherwise, it would be given out free on street corners. It has a value in the market. Everything has a value in the market. Or if it doesn't have a value, people don't want to purchase it. So first of all, the notion that it can be obtained for free is ridiculous. If he actually believes that, I think that's really sort of economic malpractice. And second, it doesn't get past, as Carol and Brian pointed out, the fundamental problem, which is a First Amendment problem, which is a issue of religious accommodation. And it's not uncommon for this administration to do this. They lost 9-0 at the Supreme Court recently, which is not easy to do, I have to say. I give them credit for getting unanimity on the Supreme Court. And the issue was whether a termination of a minister was protected by a religious exception to the EEO rules. The administration took the position that, sure, if a church fires a pastor, or a church fires a rabbi, a synagogue fires a rabbi, sure, you can file a claim with the EEOC. And the Supreme Court said, wait a second. We have a zone of protection for religious organizations that has to be protected. You don't get to pull out every regulation, every rule that governs civil and secular society and apply them in church settings. Otherwise, you cease to be a religious organization. You cease to be guided by your own principles. And that problem for the administration, I think, remains. And it's really, I think, awoken a sleeping giant here across the board, not just Catholics.
Brian, darling, on the Supreme Court question that Jennifer raises, apparently many, many states, including New York, have a similar kind of setup where the churches themselves don't have to provide the contraception coverage, but women who work for these religious organizations have a way to get it in a sideways way as part of their coverage. And apparently this went to the Supreme Court in the case of the New York state law, I believe in 2004, maybe you're familiar with it, and it was upheld. So is it as black and white as Jennifer paints it out to be, in your opinion?
Yes, I agree with Jennifer. I mean, the economic argument, when you look at it, that would be an argument for covering abortions. But clearly we would not think that it consistent with religious freedom to force Catholic institutions to pay for abortions, because it's common sense that a woman that has a child is going to cost more with health care. I mean, that's obvious. When you have kids, they cost more. So you can save costs by even covering abortions. But we do not do that because it is something that's morally offensive to these institutions. Now, maybe the Supreme Court has come down with a decision saying it's okay, but that doesn't mean that it is okay in the sense that it's consistent with the First Amendment rights of these individuals. This is something that, if it's not resolved in Congress is going to go to the court. So the court will have its second say on it in the very near future.
Do you think, though, that this is a winning issue for conservatives? If you're going to take a position that it violates the First Amendment, even though the Supreme Court says it doesn't violate the First Amendment, separation of churches or religious freedom, then, you know, where are suburban women going to be? Where are suburban Catholics, who are a lot of the swing voters in America, going to be on this after the president's compromise?
It's not a compromise. But I guess the bottom line is, I think that most people understand that if they're that they respect religion and they respect the whole idea that a Catholic institution shouldn't have to pay for something that they're against. I mean, if somebody wants to pay with their after-tax dollars that works at one of these institutions for contraception, clearly that's happening, and it's something that will continue to happen. But forcing these religious institutions to pay for abortion-inducing drugs and sterilization is inconsistent with their philosophy.
Also, Carol, let me go to Carol on this, because why invoke the bishops, as many people are doing, as if they are the church? Bishops don't speak for most Catholics on this issue, apparently, and groups are split. Certainly the male-only bishops don't speak for most Catholic women on this issue. So liberals will say, who should conservatives consider the church to be? Those in the hierarchy who speak, in effect, for Rome, or the American Catholic women?
Well, I think if you make the decision to work for a Catholic church, I think, as I said on the podcast last week, you know what you're getting into. It's not a surprise that the Catholic Church opposes abortion, that they oppose birth control, that they oppose sterilization. And if this is all news to you, then perhaps you should rethink your choice of employer, because it's been a consistent message from the Catholic Church from the top down that these things are not part of what they promote. So if you're looking for an employer that's going to cover your birth control or abortions or whatever, then you're really working at the wrong place. And it's about freedom. You have the freedom not to choose them to be your employer, and they have the freedom not to provide services that are inconsistent with their teachings.
Let me just go around the panel one time as we start to run out of time and get your quick takes on what other story came out of CPAC to your own eyes that should have been reported more, or that nobody picked up on, or just something that you saw that you think is worthy of passing along. Brian Darling?
Well, Governor Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, gave a great speech talking about how he turned that government around. And with his minimal, I mean, what he did in the state of Wisconsin was minimal to modify the union contracts of government employees. And in doing so, he put the government on the right track, yet he's under attack from all corners, it seems, of the mainstream media. I think that was underreported, that he gave such a great speech and made a very passionate defense of his tenure in office.
Jennifer Rubin?
First of all, I second what Brian says. It was one of the best speeches at CPAC. I would also point to another speech that was extremely well-regarded and bizarrely wasn't covered by the media, because he's on everybody's shortlist for VP, and that is Marco Rubio. He gave a tremendous, charismatic presentation defending conservative principles. When I interviewed him in a smaller group, he was equally impressive. He is saying he is not interested in being vice president, but as source on background told me, well, in 6 months things might change. I think whether he is on the ticket in 2012, he is clearly going to be one of the leaders in the Republican Party for a long time.
Carol?
I think the story that I don't see anybody covering is that the CPAC sort of marked the end of Newt. He might make some sort of comeback, I guess, but he delivered a very boring, basic stump speech that he's been giving. He went on to sign books, and then he went home, and very, very quietly this turned into a two-man race. We barely even mentioned him in this conversation, and we've just been talking about it as a Romney versus Santorum race, and it does seem like it's all over for Newt, and they were saying that maybe his speech that he gave is a way of easing back into not being a candidate.
Carol Markowitz, conservative blogger for WNYC's politics website, itsafreecountry.org. And everybody, we invite you to sign up for the free podcast that goes with It's a Free Country, on which Carol was a guest last week, along with me and Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. You can sign up for free on iTunes for It's a Free Country, the podcast. And Jennifer Rubin, right-turn blogger for The Washington Post. And Brian Darling, senior fellow for government studies at the Heritage Foundation and a contributor to Human Events. Thank you all very much for coming on with us after attending CPAC this weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, the 31 kinds of music eliminated from their own Grammy Awards and why some people aren't happy about it. Stay with us.